owned as a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Hummel to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for about half of U.S. executions. This show will feature an interview with Hummel, recorded directly recently from death row. Execution Watch hosts Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Danny Allen. Interview guests will also include appellate defense attorney Patrick McCann. The Execution Watch for John Hummel begins.
Good evening. Hello, we bring you breaking news on this Wednesday, June 30th edition of Execution Watch, the only electronic vigil held whenever the state of Texas performs an execution. I'm your host, Marlo Blue. Tonight, we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute 45-year-old John Hummel, condemned in the 2009 slayings of three family members in Kennedale, southeast of Fort Worth. Execution Watch and Houston Media Source TV obtained an exclusive interview with Mr. Hummel to be aired on this program only if the state of Texas carries out the execution in the second half of this program. Please stay tuned for that. I want to thank our producer, Elizabeth Stein, who has reached out to every prisoner in Texas's death row, requesting an interview since the inception of this program. Elizabeth arranged for an interview with John Hummel a couple of weeks ago, conducted by our very own Larry Douglas, and recorded by our associate and community partners at Houston Media Source TV. These interviews are often the last records of what the men and women on Texas's death row have to say. We do this to give the public a firsthand look at the person the prisoners have become and why the death penalty and maybe even life without parole is not the answer. Joining us in the studio, as it were, to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas and Mike Gillespie. Now, for those of you new to Execution Watch, this program is the first and only live electronic vigil providing firsthand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally on the World Wide Web, and we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and beyond. Texas carries out its execution at the Walls Unit in Huntsville, Texas, built in 1849. This is the only Confederate prison still standing and in use. Tonight, we go to our reporter outside of the death house in Huntsville, Danny Allen. Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Right now, the witnesses are crossing the street, and as everyone knows, that is a sign that the execution is moving forward. For those of you new to this, through the years, we know that right now John is prepared for the execution, and Miss Linda, his uncle Thomas, is walking up the stairs right now, along with the chaplains and the guards.
Do we? Was there any other witnesses that we know of?
No, I know I spoke with John and I asked him about his spiritual advisor, but if he was going to be there with him, and he started talking about something else. He really enjoyed his final meal. So he was telling me all about the chicken and the macaroni and cheese. And of course I had to stop him with the macaroni and cheese because I love it. And yeah. So he was telling me, he was really into his final meal. So I think that he was trying to occupy himself with other things.
Of course. Well, you know, during Clinton Jones's execution, there was no reported media present. And I believe that even during the execution, the activists standing where you are were told that Mr. Jones's lawyers were still in with Governor Abbott. Was that your experience?
Well, that was my experience. And I remember we kept waiting and waiting and waiting. And then we saw the chaplains, ones that we are familiar with, mm-hmm. walk out on the walkway heading towards their vehicles. And I was like, wait a minute, because they are the ones that typically go inside.
Right.
So I asked, and well, we I think it was me and Gloria asking. And the lady said, it's over. And I said, what do you mean it's over? Like, over in what context? Because, you know, that could mean anything. And she just kept walking. She wouldn't tell us. So even she knew that there was an issue with what happened. So earlier today, there's one of the Miranda is protesting out here. And she asked me, what you asked me, do I think that this will happen in the future? Well, I think that if it happens again, CDC will find another excuse. You know, maybe they won't have this excuse that the people were new.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, even the people who were new in these positions have been with the TDCJ for a long time. So,
right. And Diesel is not new. He's been in this position. He knew what was going on. So that's not acceptable, in my opinion. He knew the steps. He knew the policy and the procedure, and he knew what time it was.
Right. And knew that it was going on. It does seem to have been an intentional slight. I agree. Well, Danny, how many people are out there today?
Well, right now we have about 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, probably 12 people out here. Not as many as we've had before.
Still a good number. Good to have you there.
Good. Thank you. And we want to, again, you know, if you're in the Houston and Huntsville area, we want people to come out, you know, no matter what. I'm on a walker. You know, I have a brace, I have a broken pelvis, but I'm here. You know, you can come out here no matter what. If you're against the death penalty and you want to see an end to it.
And of course, here is right outside of the walls unit at that first main entrance. Is that correct?
That is correct. We are right smack on the intersection of 12th Street and Avenue I.
Outside that brick wall.
Yeah, that very red brick wall.
Danny, thank you for reporting. I appreciate you. Would you please let us know when you see them come out?
I sure will.
We've been speaking with Danny Allen. She's reporting for us from outside of the death chamber, what they call the walls unit in Huntsville, Texas. Now let's bring in Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie. Gentlemen, can you give us a basic rundown of what happened here and what is the case?
Well, as most death penalty cases are, Marlo, the facts are pretty horrendous. John Hummel, one, was a honorably discharged Marine veteran. Not any trouble, hadn't been any trouble at all his entire life. A very mild-mannered person. But for whatever reason, and there can be many, he, back in 2009, killed his wife, pregnant wife, his daughter, and his father-in-law. And after having killed them, what he did was that the killing was bludgeoning and stabbing. I think he stabbed the wife 35 times. He then set the house on fire. And after having set the house on fire, he left. He came back hours later. So this whole incident occurred 9, 10 o'clock at night. He comes back around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, parks across the street, and just sits there and watches until a police officer comes over and engages him in conversation. He then identifies himself as the person who lived in that house. And he was asking them the question repeatedly, did anybody get out okay? Did everybody get out okay? Well, the police officers start to talk to him for a while, and they ask him, as a person of interest, would you come down and give us a statement? He did that. Actually, the police had him follow them to the station, and he then gave them a statement saying that, you know, he had left the house to go Christmas shopping. This was on December the 9th. That, you know, he came back and he finds that the house is burning. Well, after giving a lengthy written statement, they let him leave. He goes back to the job the next day, picks up his paycheck, I believe, and then leaves. Actually goes to Mexico. A few days later, he's coming back from Mexico, and he's arrested there. And the Tarrant County officials, police officials, were there waiting for. They got there after he was arrested, and they actually got him to. He was very cooperative the entire time, in terms of allowing them to have the pants he was wearing that night, and that they questioned him and noticed that there was blood on his socks and so forth. Well, the next day, a couple of days later, when he's coming back from Tijuana, when he's arrested, he also allows them to go into his hotel room, and they collected a ton of evidence on him. And then he after that, he even confesses on several different occasions as to exactly what had happened. So at trial, the jury didn't take very long to find him guilty. The mitigation evidence, that is, the in a capital case, the real, and especially a case like this, the real defense needs to be that of mitigation. And there just wasn't a whole lot of mitigating evidence provided to him, and particularly as it for him, particularly as it relates to the possibility of his. This guy was in military intelligence. A fairly smart individual, but something appears to have happened to him either during his childhood, during his lifetime, or in the military that caused him to act that way, to cause him to snap in this case. The jury gave him the death penalty. And I guess that's Mike, I guess you want to talk about either the appellate, either Mike or Pat, in terms of the appellate process.
Let Pat talk about the appellate process.
Well, sure. This is a great time to bring in our special guest, of course. Patrick McCann is a Houston defense attorney. He's an expert in Texas appellate and post-conviction remedies. Pat, what was the appeals based on for Mr. Hummel?
Well, Michael Mola, a well-respected attorney up in Dallas, had done the recent attempt to get a new trial for Mr. Hummel. He had raised issues regarding future dangerousness and a failure to find and present post-traumatic stress disorder, which he believed in the pleadings that Mr. Hummel suffered from, as Larry alluded to. And there's a case on point on that from the Supreme Court called Porter v. McCollum, where a veteran's background was not brought forward. And it had a great deal of mitigation, both in terms of positive service to his country, but also in terms of what the veteran had endured and seen and unfortunately not gotten treatment for. And I happen to have worked with a number of veterans in some of the veteran courts in Texas. And I can tell you that not trying to make any kind of connections between veterans and crime, simply saying that the stresses that build up if someone does have PTSD can often cascade into a series of problems that if you don't get a hold of them early or get treatment for them and recognize how to ratchet yourself back down and get help when you can't, it can result in real problems and real tragedies. And unfortunately, this may be one of them. I will say that Michael Mola has said that there are no more legal issues for him to raise. So there is nothing pending as far as we know right now. So I would not expect any last minute attempts that would come through to stop this. Michael's known as a fighter, so if he has exhausted every bit of good investigation he can do, then it's pretty much exhausted. The tough part on this is that the appellate process is designed to second guess lawyers. It's both on direct appeal and in habeas, where one gets to introduce new facts and bring in new issues, both on the state side and sometimes on the federal side. One is allowed to challenge the competency and the investigative efforts of the lawyers at trial. It's one of the difficult facts that trial lawyers accept as part of doing their duty. And in Texas, that is split between two different groups of lawyers. You have your direct appeal folks, and then under Texas law, either the Office of Capital and Forensic Writs takes the case, or if they are overloaded or turned down the case for some reason, then someone who is qualified to handle 11071 habeas writs takes it and runs with that. It is a daunting bit of work, and my hat's off to Mr. Mola for taking on the difficult task. I think that it appears that since the clemency was rejected and Michael has said that there will be no more efforts on this, that his Mr. Hummel's appeals have been exhausted and he is headed towards execution tonight.
As we said a little bit earlier while talking with our reporter from the Walls unit, Miss Danny, she basically said that the witnesses have already crossed the road, which is our usual signal to let us know that the execution is currently underway. We will, of course, continue to update that. And at last check, as you said, Pat, there were no appeals still going on. I want to know that with the question of mitigation, especially with somebody who was in such a secretive job, mitigation in his trial, do you think that was standing against him? How does that work out in something like this?
The way the question is worded, it's two parts. First, is the person likely to commit acts of criminal violence that would constitute a future danger to society? That's the future danger question. The second is, given all the facts in both guilt and innocence and punishment, is there a sufficient mitigating circumstance to warrant a sentence other than death? So even the words contain sufficient and implies, and I'm going to say this, although the Court of Criminal Appeals has said we are not a weighing state, I'm going to simply say that the jurors weigh this. Having tried these cases and spoken with jurors afterwards and read some of the things that were said, the jurors weigh good and bad. Now, each one may come to a different conclusion on that balancing, but I think they certainly do weigh those things. And
what venue was this case actually tried? I mean, Kendall's just a small little place. Was the trial actually there, or was it in Fort Worth?
In Tarrant County, in Fort Worth, Tarrant County.
A little bit more of a pool there to choose from, indeed.
They have outstanding trial lawyers in that bar. The issue is always, you know, we'd all like to think it's the trial lawyers or the appellate lawyers that get you there, but most times it's the facts, and the facts that one can find. Obviously, the state has marshaled the worst of those, but I think Larry's earlier allusion to the mitigation being the important thing in this case, I think it's true. I think that's what Porter McCollum says. And I think, in all honesty, trying to find enough sufficient mitigating circumstance to overcome the brutal deaths of his family, I think would have been a tall order for any team. I would hope that they were able to get access to his records. I know from working with a lot of folks that getting VA records and getting military records about what someone went through can be difficult. People don't always want to talk about it. To give an example, there were recruiters in the Oklahoma City bombing who lived through that experience. Those are military folks who were not on a front line, at least they didn't think they were. And those folks themselves would be reluctant oftentimes to come forward in a way, because if you look at their records, unless you happen to remember what happened on those days, you would see hometown recruiting. And you would not see what they went through. And I think that's a trap that when you're looking at VA records, that you have to avoid. And I say this because if you look at someone who was in the infantry, the A2nd Airborne from, say, 1986 to 1990, you would say, oh, they got out before the Gulf War. So what could they have seen? Well, the 82nd was the one that jumped into Panama. And there was quite a bit that they saw. If you look at Marine Corps records of some folks on the Atlantic and West Coast, if you look back in the 90s, the Marines did a couple of different forced, what they call non-combatant emergency evacuation operations in Liberia and the Ivory Coast. Those were places that were going through horrible civil war and disruption. And the folks that were there saw far worse in getting embassy staff out than many other people would have, simply because they were exposed to what the rebels were doing to the government troops and vice versa. So you've got to remember that because someone's in the military, but not necessarily in a time of obvious war, doesn't mean that they didn't have trauma in their operational service.
The secrets that they can tell, if only they could tell, I guess. Mike, what's your opinion on the idea of him being a present danger?
Which is a point I like to discuss and discuss it with Pat. The whole concept of the death penalty is future dangerousness. How did they come up with that with him, who has no history of violence, no history of any activity, no drug, no alcohol history? Is it the Dr. Doom case where the acts are so bad they consider that you're a future danger because you poisoned the whole neighborhood? Is it just the fact that that crime was so bad that's a future dangerous in and of itself? But don't they need more than that? I thought the concept of future dangerousness was that once you're in prison for life, you're a danger to fellow inmates. Is that not the way it's supposed to be? Or is it supposed to be that a jury can decide that what you did is so bad, we're going to kill you for it?
Unfortunately, the last sentence you just stated, Mike, is what the actual legal standard is. Under a test called the Berry case, the Berry factors, past criminal history is certainly an indicator of potential future violence. The problem here is that you can base a sentence in a death penalty case just on the crime committed alone, And sadly for Mr. Hummel, this was brutal enough that I don't think people could get past it. And if he would snap and hurt people that close to him, most likely the jurors concluded that this person could not.
But what if there was a moment of insanity? What if his whole life was such that this is not typical, and one day one thing happens and he flips, of course, with his military background? Now, I talked to him in Huntsville, too. And what he told me now doesn't reflect in the record. The record claimed that he had a girlfriend. The record claims that his girlfriend broke up with him because he had a wife, and that's why he went and did this. But what he told me was that his wife had a 13-year-old niece, her nephew, and she had always said that that was her nephew. He found out that day that that was her son or daughter from a prior relationship. That's what made him flip. That's what made him kill her. That's what made him kill everybody else. Could that be considered part of the military situation where he snapped? And if he did snap, is that really future dangerousness?
PTSD has a series of episodes that can be considered and called flashbacks. It's actually entering a dissociative state where you can return to a time of crisis, where you may have been in combat or in a dangerous situation or something stressful. If they could have proved that that's what happened to him, that I think you could have had something to perhaps make that argument. That does not quite rise to an insanity defense, but it also is difficult to prove. And the burden on that would be for the defense lawyers at trial to prove that he was actually in that state.
Does it make sense from a legal position that the question of execution should be how you act in prison, not how you act before you get to prison?
I've argued that, but that's not what the legal standard is. The legal standard is that it's society, and society could include and should include, I believe, mostly prison. However, in fairness to others on the other side, the society in prison includes nonviolent offenders, chaplains, medical people like nurses, LVNs, and it also includes people who make deliveries, janitorial people. So it is not something that I think most people would have considered likely. I think you can make the argument that unless you can prove someone's an escape risk, that that they would not be there. But keep in mind, in his early times, if I understood the facts correctly, he fled to Mexico. So saying that he would be a flight risk or an escape risk in this case does mean that there's a risk that anybody can get out. And you will hear that from state lawyers all the time.
Gentlemen, we're moving on to 6:28 p.m. right now. Again, thank you all for joining us. We are listening to Pat McCann, to Larry Douglas, to Mike Gillespie, and to Danny Allen. And we are here in the electronic vigil of for execution watch for the execution of John Hummel. And because the witnesses have crossed the road, because of all the other aspects that we believe the execution is being carried out at this time, we will be bringing you our special interview. Larry Douglas was in Huntsville to interview John Hummel. Larry, this was your very first interview from death row. How did the experience affect you?
Well, Marlo, as you know, I've been participating in this broadcast for several years, but have never been assigned to go to the row and interview the inmate there. And so reviewing the facts of case, and I've practiced law for a lot of years, and I have been to various differing prison units over that term of years. but nothing quite affected me. None of that experience as much as going to the road for the first time and sitting there and having a discussion with a man who would likely be executed by the state of Texas. Didn't know what to expect. So everything was new to me. Just being at the row, and I didn't really even think about it until I got there. And then when we started the interview, to sit and talk to this man, he was such a calm natured person, very engaging. It gave me an overwhelming sense of helplessness, because my feeling is, as a lawyer, you try to figure out if there's some kind of way that you can help your client. Now, he's not a client of mine by any stretch of imagination, but is there anything that we can do as a society to both for Hummel and for people who are victims of crime? My concern is, what should we as a country be doing? And those issues just overwhelmed me as I'm sitting there talking to him. And my thoughts were, you know, is there something else that could be done procedurally? What's the most appropriate thing to do? And I couldn't come up with anything. And that left me with an overwhelming sense of hopelessness.
It's a terrifying feeling, I know.
It was such an eye opener that you know, it's something that I'm not sure that I'll ever want to do on any of those again, but I know it has to be done. So it was something that I really, really had a hard time. But it still concerns me from time to time now, just thinking about sitting and talking to it.
Well, now, as promised, we bring an exclusive, uncut, unedited interview with Mr. John Hummel.
Tell us about growing up and so forth. Where are you from?
Well, I was born in Arlington, Texas. But when I was 3, going on 4, we moved to South Carolina. And that's where I grew up.
Okay. Tell about family, mom, dad, what's going on there?
Let's see. My dad worked at, he got a job at Kohler Company. They make, you know, bathroom
the
fixtures.
The K-O-H-L-E-R. That
right.
Kohler. Okay, yeah,
got it. He was a kill operator.
A what?
Kill. You know,
oh, the fire.
Right.
Okay.
Where they baked the toilets and sinks and stuff to clean. Right. So we moved to South Carolina because he had gotten that job. And shortly after we moved there, we moved to a farm. He met this dentist who had a farm as like a little hobby. Had like 50 cows on it, and we'd sell them for beef or whatever. So we took care of the farm, you know, fed the cows, mended fences and stuff like that. So, you know, I grew up helping my dad do that.
Great. Brothers, sisters?
Yeah, I have an older sister. She's like 9.5 years older than me.
Okay. And how were things growing up for you?
Pretty good. I mean, no complaints. I mean, just typical, hardworking American family.
Great. And you, how were things for you?
I mean,
were you happy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't want for much. I, you know, got, you know, lower middle class American family, pretty much.
Tell me about school.
School was okay. I had a little trouble when I was in the fourth grade because, my sister had moved out. She moved back to Texas. So I kind of didn't really do much schoolwork. So I got held back in the fourth grade because of that. So I had to repeat the fourth grade.
Your sister moved back to Texas? And
right, because she was 18.
But you were saying that somehow that impacted you?
Yeah, because, well, she was more of a second mother.
Oh, okay.
To me, then. Because of the age difference.
Okay.
You know, my mom used her more as a nanny type, you know, second mother than a sister. So, you know, she helped raise me more than just being a sibling, you know.
Kept you straight, kept you in,
right,
doing your homework and stuff.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
She moved out and you
slacked off, right.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about high school. Did you graduate?
Yes. I was 20th in my class, and that was without even really trying.
How big a class were you?
It was a small 1A school, so there's like 50, 60 students.
Okay. Well, in the top half, top quarter of the class.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So pretty good grades.
Right.
Then what'd you do?
Well, let's see. At the time, I was working at Hardee's. It's kind of like a McDonald's. It's a fast food restaurant.
Hardee's, where the burgers are charcoal broil?
Right. Yeah, well, okay. It's kind of like that, yeah, right? Okay. I was working from there from the age of 15 till I graduated high school. Then I got a job working at BMG. They sold CDs and like TV Guide. You'd see an advertisement, you know, 12 CDs for the price of one.
Okay, yeah.
Right, so, you know, I worked there for a couple of years.
What'd you do there?
Basically just picked CD orders.
Okay, filling the orders.
Right, filling orders.
Okay.
And then a couple of years working there, I just got tired of it and I went and joined the Marines.
Now, whatever caused you to do that?
Well, I'd always wanted to be in the military.
Is that right?
Right, because, you know, growing up, like watching military movies with my dad. So, you know, I always wanted to be in the military, so I finally did. And
no recruiter approached you or anything?
Right, yeah. I went to the recruiter office myself. I was like 21, about to turn 22.
Now, I hear that that's pretty tough.
Oh, yeah. The Marines are the toughest because it's only a small percent of people that go through boot camp actually make it through boot camp. They've got the hardest boot camp in the military service.
You made it through.
Right. First time without. Because sometimes if you, you know, fail one aspect, like, you know, the first month is like academic, you know, knowledge and stuff. If you fail the test, you get held back to another platoon. And if you fail something three times, you get kicked out. So, like, when I first went, we had, like, around 80, 90 people in our platoon. So, you know, going through the course of it, you know, some people would get dropped because they had failed, like, the academic part or the rifle range part or the PFT. So, you know, some people would get dropped to another platoon, and then we'd pick up people who got dropped previously. So by the time we made it through to graduation, out of the 80 or 90 of us that started, only like 30-something of us was there from beginning to end. The other half of the platoon we picked up along the way.
Okay, so you're saying that when you say people got dropped, they just got recycled back?
Right, well, like for the academic or like for the rifle range, if you don't score high enough on the rifle range to make marksman, which is the lowest score you can make, you get held back, kind of like failing a grade in high school. So you get held back, everybody else goes on with their training, and you get picked up with another platoon who's just arriving to the rifle range part. Okay. And then if you fail again, you get held back again. And if you fail it a third time, you can't even be a Marine. They'll kick you out.
And so the qualifying is marksman?
Yeah, it's marksman, sharpshooter, expert, right?
I learned that in high school ROTC.
Right. So. Thing about it, the Army has the same qualifications, but the qualification for the Army's expert is the same as the Marine Corps' marksman.
Oh, God. Are you serious?
So, yeah, if you can't even get expert in the Army, you couldn't even be a Marine. At least that's how it was when I was in.
Okay.
They just have higher standards.
Okay. You say that with some pride.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they don't call them the few and the proud for no reason. But yeah, when I first, you know, went to the recruiters, I had to take the ASVAB test, which, you know.
It's the qualifying test.
Right. To see what jobs you would qualify for.
Okay.
Well, after I took it, I qualified for every job in the Marine Corps.
Great.
Right. But half of those got knocked out and partial. And then the other ones, they can only have, like, there's only room for so many people in certain jobs. So out of what was left, I signed up to be an Amtrak driver. That's what I was going to do. Was going to be an Amtrak driver. But while I was in boot camp, some positions opened up for intelligence specialist. And you have to have a high IQ to even qualify for that. Five of us in my platoon qualified for it. So they pulled us into a room and asked us if we wanted to switch over to intelligent specialist. So three of us did, and I was one of the three that switched my MOS to intelligence specialist.
So you're going to drop that high IQ on me without telling me what it actually is? You're going to tell me what it is?
Around 130.
130? That's pretty high.
Yeah, you have to have like a, I think it's a minimum of 120 to be an intelligence specialist.
Okay, now how long did you serve in the Marine Corps?
I did 4.5 years because I signed up for 4, but I extended my enlistment for 6 months so I could go on a deployment, because I would have EAS'd like 2 or 3 months into the deployment.
Okay, EAS means?
Estimated in-service term of something. I can't remember what.
The outdate.
Right.
Okay.
So I extended it 6 months so I could go on to deployment.
Deployment where?
Well, it's I was stationed in California in Camp Pendleton. Okay. So we go down to San Diego to get on the ship. Then the ship leaves San Diego, goes to Hawaii, then goes to Australia, and then just bounces around the, Asian and Middle East.
Okay.
So, like on my first deployment we went on, the whole thing with East Timor happened. It's a island in the Philippines. They didn't want to belong to the Philippines anymore. So the people voted like 70-something percent to separate. Well, the 20-something percent that didn't want to separate went on a rampage and started killing people and just went ballistic. So we had to go there. We didn't do anything on the ground. We was there to support Australia. Australia's military went to actually help the people, but we was there to provide Australia with heavy helo lift support for moving troops and supplies and stuff.
Okay, before we go any further, let me just thank you for your service, man.
Oh, you're welcome.
We need people to accept. That's what keeps this country safe.
Right.
So now you were an intelligence specialist.
Right.
What'd you do? What does that even mean?
At the level I was on, being in the infantry battalion level, my job was primary. I'd be sitting in the headquarters tent, you know, a couple of miles away from like the front line.
Wait a minute, I thought you were on a ship.
Well, yeah, but when you go and land,
okay,
into the theater, you know, combat theater. So like we'd be, you know, deployed, you know, we'd go into the land, the frontline troops would be where they're at. We'd be a couple of miles behind them in the headquarters, but I'd be on a radio talking with like the scout snipers who's in the area, because they'd have like eyes on the enemy. So you're like, they'd say, you know, we got this, and this at this grid coordinates. So I'd plot it on the map, let operations know, hey, at this grid coordinates, you got, you know, a platoon of whatever with light weapons, and then they would decide how best to take them out.
So you coordinate them by providing information.
Right.
Oh, great.
I'd also hand out maps, build terrain models of the area, which would be like a three-dimensional map made out of sand, so they could, you know, get a better view of the area. I'd teach how to read maps and stuff like that.
Great. Okay. Map reading, huh?
Yeah. Teach the infantry how to read a map, so when they're out there in the field, they can look at the map and actually know where they are and where they need to go.
Okay. Then you got out of the Marine Corps.
Right.
And what did you do?
Little odd jobs here and there. I worked at a Crackle Barrel as a prep cook. I worked at a cigarette factory for a while. Worked filling orders. Worked as a security guard. Things like that.
Okay. Is there anything at all that you'd like to talk to the public about the situation you're in right now? If you don't want to, don't do that.
I mean, I can't really think of anything off
the top. Okay.
Nothing's like heavy on my heart or nothing like that. I mean, as far as what I did, I do truly regret ever doing it. I mean, not a day goes by that I don't like kick myself in the butt for, you know, what I've done. But I have made my peace with God, and I know I've been forgiven by Him. So I know when I do die, whether it's with a needle in my arm or a heart attack tonight in my cell, I'm going to heaven. So
that's good. That's really good.
All right.
Okay. And then I guess at the time you were working as a security guard? Okay.
Right.
Okay. Tell me about that job. Was it a pay job for you?
Well, this was the one when I was in South Carolina. I was with a security guard company. You know, they provide security guards for various companies in the area. And I was working for this place called Beverage Air. They kind of make the, like the vending machines with like coolers and stuff in them.
Okay.
Right, they did that. So I was the third shift security guy, like be at the gate, but they didn't have a third shift, so there was no one there at the company at the time I was there but me. So, you know, I'd be there all alone, make sure nobody like broke in to mess with anything. So, you know, I'd be at the security guard shack, and then every like hour or so I'd go and walk around the perimeter, walk through the building and stuff, and, you know, make sure no one has snuck in to, you know, vandalize or steal stuff and things like that.
So it was the kind of facility that needed 24-hour security.
Right.
But at 8 of those hours, you said the third shift, nobody was there. No employees were there.
Right, no employees were there. It was just me all by myself.
But the facility did still need to have security.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It was kind of a lonely job, wasn't it?
If you don't mind being alone.
Oh, okay. And I take it you didn't mind.
Right.
Okay. You could always do a lot. I guess you were allowed to read and do other things.
Yeah, like reading, you know. I mean, you can't really do much because, you know, you got to keep watch. You know, you got security cameras and monitors to watch. Sometimes the truck driver might come in late at night to make a delivery, so you'd have to let him in and then let him back out the gate and stuff like that, so.
Okay. So how long were you on that job?
I was working two jobs. I was working that job and working the security, at the cigarette factory at the same time.
Doing what at the cigarette factory?
Just filling orders. Actually, it was more of a cigarette warehouse than a factory. It was like a local brand for the area.
Okay.
It wasn't like a real big name brand. It was like a generic brand. And that they sold like cigarettes to the convenience stores within like maybe a 60-mile radius of it or whatever. So I'd fill the orders, and the other guys would like deliver them.
So this was two full-time jobs?
Yeah. So I was working 40 hours as the security guard and 40 hours at the, you know, because I'm working during the day, you know, 8 hours a day during at the cigarette warehouse. Get off there and go to the security job. I only did that for like a couple of months before I had to quit the security job to continue at the cigarette because I was making more money there. It's just too much.
Okay.
Working two full-time jobs at the same time.
Okay.
And then that place ended up going out of business. And then that's when I moved back to Texas. Because I couldn't find any other jobs right there in South Carolina at the time. So I moved back to Texas and worked at a convenience store for a while. Then I got a job at Williams & Dickie. You know, they make the overalls, clothes. And I worked there until I fell at work. I was taking like a 70-pound box off the conveyor belt. And somebody had left some boxes on the floor, so when I took a couple of steps back to go put it on the pallet, I tripped over the box, hurt my back, ended up getting two herniated discs, and that took me out of work for 2 years.
Okay.
And then as I was recovering from that, Crohn's disease hit on my stomach. They had to remove 26 inches of small intestines. And so that took me out for another 2 years. So for 4 years, you know, I'm laid up on my back, can't work, can't do nothing, can't support my family. So, you know, that was a very stressful time, and that added to, you know, why I did what I did. I mean, it's no excuse for what I did, but
Tell me about that, man. How does that relate?
Well, at the time, to consolidate ourselves, We was living with, you know, my wife's father.
Okay.
And he was disabled. I'm disabled. You know, she, you know, my wife's kind of supporting us. We didn't really get much money from, you know, workers' comp from me hurting my back. When I tried to get on disability, I got denied that. So, you know, I'm laid up, unable to work, no money coming in on my part until, you know, like I said, after 4 years, I finally was able to go back to work as a security guard.
Oh, okay.
Again, okay. That's where I was working. I was working, I forget the company's name. I think it's like Champion Security or whatever. I can't remember. But they had me working at the time, the Walls Hospital. I was a security guard there, so I'd sit at the little security guard desk at the in the OR, the waiting room, at night as a third shift job again.
And, but this is at the hospital, so...
At the hospital,
at
so...
At the hospital, that was still activity at the hospital. It wasn't like at the
warehouse. Yeah, right. So, you know, I'm at the security desk in the OR emergency room, the ER waiting room. And it wasn't a real big hospital. It was just a little local hospital. But, you know, they got people coming in all hours of the night and day and stuff. And every hour I'd get up and, like, walk through the parking lot, make sure no one's vandalizing cars, or walk through the hospital, make sure no one's trying to break into where they keep all the pills and stuff, and no one's trying to steal equipment and stuff.
So your health you'd recovered pretty well by that time.
Right.
Feeling pretty good.
Enough to do a security guard job where you're basically sitting on your butt all night and get up every now and then and walk around. I mean, I was still limited because of my back and the Crohn's disease. I was still limited because, like, can't lift anything over 50 pounds, can't stay on my feet for too long. But I was good enough to do a security guard job.
Okay. Okay, now you are familiar with the Execution Watch.
Yeah, the show, right.
Okay. We're going to broadcast this. Hopefully we won't, but if we do.
Right.
Is there anything that you'd like to just say to any of our listeners coming from you? Anything at all?
If they don't know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior, they really need to really look into that.
That's your message.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, do what I did. You know, don't just take other people's word for it. You know, pick up the Bible yourself and actually read it for yourself to see what it says instead of what other people says it says.
Okay.
And, you know, do it with an open mind and an open heart and, you know, see what happens.
Okay. In terms of advice to yourself, you know, let's say a year or so before this happened, is there anything you'd want to let yourself know?
I mean, I really don't know how to put it into words, but, you know, don't do it, basically.
Good advice.
Yeah. Well, actually, it'd be better, you know, don't hold things in. You know, if something's bothering you, let someone know. Because holding it in, keeping it in, you know, years, you know, stuff that happened, you know, years ago before I even got married, you know, just holding it in, building, you know, just building up, just, it's not good for it. It's not good.
That's what happened to you.
Right. Okay. And, you know, instead of, you know, talking it out with someone, you know, whether it was my wife, sister, anybody, you know, complete stranger, you know, just, you know, talk it out. You can't just hold stuff in. You gotta have an outlet. And if you don't have an outlet, that pressure's just going to build and build. And before you know it, you're sitting on death row.
John Hummel. That's wonderful advice. It's been good talking to you. I tell you, you've helped me considerably just during this discussion. Okay. And I just want to, right now, I just want to thank you again.
You're welcome.
For allowing us to sit down and talk to you. And to, if we have to, and we hope we don't have to.
Right.
But if it comes to that, I think your words will be helpful to our listeners.
I hope
and to
so.
The viewers.
Right.
You have a good day, sir.
You too.
You take care.
All right. Bye.
That was the final interview with Mr. John Hummel, heard here in its entirety, unedited and uncut. This will be archived on the Execution Watch and Houston Media Source websites as a final message from the man who now lays dead in Huntsville, Texas. It's time to wrap up an Execution Watch for today. Please join us on September 9th when Texas plans to usher John Ramirez into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing live. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty in the state of Texas, join us on Facebook at Execution Watch, online at executionwatch.org. Thank you to our guest, Pat McCann, our panel, Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Death House reporter, Danny Allen, executive producer, Elizabeth Stein, KPFT and Pacifica, executive producer and technical advisor, Otis McClay, and Houston Media Source technical producer, Mark Pirtle. Up next, the Rock and Soul Review. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.